Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of the Sons of History podcast. We're going to be diving into the world of espionage. We've got a fantastic guest. We had him on about a year ago. His name is William Maz, and he wrote a book called The Bucharest Dossier. And we're going to be talking about his follow-up book, The Bucharest Legacy, Rise of the Oligarchs. So we're going to be talking about spies and oligarchs. And the guy who's going to be joining me, there he is. Hello, sir.
What do you want? Hey, I have something for you.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do. You ready? All right. My shoes. Remember when I used to do...
Oh, yeah. Your MMA shoes.
My MMA shoes.
Oh, and by the way, people, I know that we were, Alan, because he's such an MMA guy, he was saying that he fought UFC. No, he didn't, because UFC is actually a company called Ultimate Fighting Championships. Alan fought MMA.
I fought MMA. Did I say UFC?
But he never was in UFC.
Did I say UFC or did I say MMA?
You did. You said UFC.
All right. Well, okay, I fought MMA. Here's my, these were my boxing gloves. And now this was my standard issued equipment. Wait, why are you walking away?
Hey, man, I got to get something.
So I had to wear these. Now, when I was there, this was at a time when they could sit there and they could wail on your, you know, important parts. So,
well, hey. Like this right here, this is called a Golden Gloves Championship Trophy.
Yeah.
When I won the Golden Gloves for 168 to 176 pounds in 2010. It's been a minute. But I still train a little bit, you know. I still got, yeah, you know, we try to take care of ourselves just in case the CIA or the FBI wants to come calling and ask if we want to be agents. You know, you got to stay in shape, man.
Hey, they didn't, you know what? They did not care. They did not even bring up. But I mean, I was in shape when back in 2002 when I was talking with them.
And you didn't like, do you see that movie Step Brothers?
Yeah.
When he pulls up his shirt and he's got like the 6-pack and everything, or the 8-pack.
No, I don't remember. You should have done that. I remember.
Come on, man! You see this? You don't even care.
No, I remember the interview. They were in that closet.
Oh yeah.
The ketchup. I smell ketchup. It, sour cream and onions. It's in my mouth now.
Hello, lady.
That was, you know, that was a very funny movie.
Dude, it is a very funny movie. Pamb. Oh, the bee is silent. They show up in tuxedos. It's a very funny movie.
When he told her to shut up. Yep, shut up.
You shut up. You shut up. All right, man. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't yet, subscribe to our podcast wherever you're listening or watching. If you're watching on YouTube, push the subscribe button. Maybe leave us a like and a comment. That would be nice. And also, if you're listening just audio version, leave a nice 5-star rating and a review. And look, if you're going to leave a review, like a 1-star review, like somebody left the other day, and you want to make a comment, don't make the comment in the title section because I can't read all of it. So I have no idea what you're talking about. I have no idea what you're referencing. So the person who did that the other day, I have no idea what you're talking about. Your automatic unfollow. Not surprising because we do say things that are slightly offensive, probably to the hypersensitive. Not that I care. But anyways, so if you are going to leave a nice review or a terrible review, do me a favor. Don't leave your review in the heading. Okay? Leave it in the body.
Did you read? I mean, was there anything in the body or did this guy write everything in the...
He wrote like something really long, or she wrote, I can't remember, something really long in the title. I'm like, I have no idea what they're saying. But then it said like automatic unfollow. And I was like, oh, you know what? Okay, that's fine.
For which topic?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying, man. But anyways, I'm going to drop that. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we're going to bring on our guest, William Maz. He likes us to call him Bill. We got that situated last time. So he's a great interview. He's a wealth of knowledge. And I will tell you this, I'm a big spy novel fan. And his debut novel, The Bucharest Dossier, is top three, top five on my list. And I've read a lot of spy novels. And then he recently came out this year, The Bucharest Legacy. And we're going to be talking about his later book that's going to be coming out. And so that's going to be exciting. You know, look, the guy's a mover and a shaker. He's doing stuff. He's writing things. What the hell have you ever done, Alan? Don't answer that question. I don't want to know. Ladies and gentlemen, William Maz, he's going to be joining us. He's also a graduate of Harvard University and Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And he was actually born in Bucharest. So I'm saying that name right, correct, Alan?
Bucharest?
I know we had a conversation last time.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Good. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we've got William Maz on the line. Bill, how are you doing, man?
Wonderful. How are you? Thanks for having me.
We are good. It is a pleasure to have you again to talk about your second book, The Rise of the Oligarchs. Hey, you already know, I think I let it be known to the high heavens how big of a fan I am of your work. Let alone I'm just a huge spy novel fan, but big fan of your work. And I'm going to ask this now before we get going. So I've read both of the books, The Bucharest Dossier and The Bucharest Legacy. There's a third one in the works, right?
There is. And in fact, it follows no longer, the same characters, but we are in Russia next. And the rise of Putin.
Uh-oh. All right. Well, perfect. That'll work well.
It already sounds a bit ominous.
Uh-huh. Speak of the devil, actually, because that's who we were just talking about off the air. So, Alan, you want to jump in with your first question? I know you got one.
Yes. Yeah. Now, this first question is going to kind of, I don't know if you saw the movie GoldenEye, the first James Bond with that Remington Steele guy. Don't even remember his name.
Pierce Brosnan?
Yeah, thank you very much. Couldn't remember. He wasn't as good as the others anyway. But now we know that the Cold War created a hotbed of espionage, and your books are about, you know, they're spy novels. So when the Cold War ended, how did the espionage change between the power states, you know, like the Warsaw Pact, Soviets, the NATO? How did it all change once the Iron Curtain fell?
Well, before we do that, let me tell you that for the past 30 years, we've had propeller heads on television telling us that the Cold War is over. And then recently, the same ones came back to tell us that the Cold War has perhaps returned. And they were wrong in both instances, because the Cold War never left. And it just basically took another form. Espionage writers versus the actual espionage. So the actual espionage, for a while, from our point of view, changed and focused on the Middle East. The CIA changed. It used to be a intelligence gathering agency, and then it became more and more a paramilitary agency, got involved with certain military units and went into Afghanistan and other places to do more actionable things than they used to do. Most of the time, it was a matter of gathering evidence, gathering intelligence, having assets, developing, you know, deep moles and so forth. So that has changed. It has returned back to Russia and to China, although it never left. Our interest in China never left. Our interest in Russia left because Russia was bankrupt. And we thought basically they're done for, at least for a generation. And so our eyes were off the ball a little bit, and we didn't think that they would be a problem. I can go into a little bit about how they became a problem, which is what I talk about in my third book. But in terms of espionage thrillers, I mean, Jean Le Carré gave up. And when Jean Le Carré gives up, you know that the Cold War espionage thriller has lost its luster. And he was himself, I think, befuddled for a long time. He started writing books about the Middle East and about chemical companies, about other things that, and he basically wasn't the same writer anymore. But I think the Cold War espionage thriller is back. And no, I didn't talk to Putin and tell him to invade Ukraine so he can boost up my sales.
Okay, well, I guess we'll have to go. We'll have to take your word for that one. No, it is interesting because Alan, I think you and I had a conversation probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, saying that very same thing, that the Cold War isn't over, and to an extent, we lost the Cold War because of the rise of China to an extent. How do you feel about the Cold War continuing and with the quote unquote fall of the Soviet Union and communism, like, do you think that we won, lost the Cold War, or was it a stalemate, armistice type of thing? Like, what do you think was the ultimate 1991 result of the Cold War?
I think the Cold War we won hands down, in fact. But I mean, Yeltsin himself, and Gorbachev realized, I mean, actually, you have to go, if you really study it, you have to go back to Andropov when he was the longest KGB acting leader. Andropov in the 60s and 70s, before Gorbachev, before Yeltsin, realized that they were losing. Okay, they were losing economically. They couldn't feed their people. They couldn't sell anything on the Western market. They couldn't produce anything worth selling. And in fact, the funny thing is, they started looking at their black market, and they realized that the black market is able to provide things that the government could not. And as early as this late 60s and early 70s, Andropov started making deals with the black marketeers. And in fact, Stalin used to use the black market himself, the gangsters, the mafia kings. And they made Andropov made a deal with the Russian mob, which existed even during the communist days, to import goods that Russia could not make itself and didn't know how to import because it needed basically hard currency to buy anything from the West. So there was a symbiotic relationship, in fact, between the government, the communist government, and the Russian mob going all the way back to the 60s and 70s to provide the people with more goods than the government could and forestall a uprising or a revolution because they were very scared of that. So we won the Cold War. I mean, Gorbachev admitted that with Glasnost and Perestroika. They couldn't keep up with us. Yeltsin came and visited our country, and he said, he was quoted as saying, "We lost 80 years of our history with communism." So they knew communism was dead. Putin himself was quoted as saying communism was a dead end. He doesn't want communism. He's not returning to communism. He's returning to a strong central government and an oligarch system, which, by the way, an oligarch system, if you want to talk about the oligarchs, goes all the way back to Aristotle, the definition of an oligarch. An oligarch is not just a wealthy person, okay? An oligarch is a wealthy person whose wealth depends on the king. or the ruler. So Bill Gates would not be considered an oligarch. We've had oligarchs throughout history. They were not called that. They were called dukes and earls and barons and counts, but they were oligarchs. How did they get their wealth? Most of them were given land by the king after a battle. They were usually either political allies, or they were great generals or great warriors. And they were given a title, and they said, okay, this is Essex, and now you are the Earl of Essex. They were responsible for the serfs living on the land. If the king needed money, they would raise taxes. If the king needed to fight a battle, these oligarchs would raise an army. Why did the king do that? Because the king needed a network of people powerful to keep him in power, who had skin in the game. Their wealth, and often their heads, depended on the king remaining in power. And they knew if their loyalty waned, the king could take that wealth away. Communism, which is the irony of it all, was a response to the oligarch system of the czar. The czar is the same as a king. He had his own nobility. And then there was the serfs underneath, very little middle class. And it was a way of keeping the population under control. So the communism came in with egalitarianism, with equality, right? And no one was more important than anybody else. Well, the irony is that they created their own oligarchs. And here's how, which is very interesting. I can give you the Ceausescu, but it happened everywhere the same way. During Ceausescu's regime, he was in power from 65 to 89. He knew that everybody in the government stole from government coffers. That was the communist system. Everybody took a piece of the budget. And the higher you were, the bigger piece you took. And it happens today, by the way. Everybody is surprised why Putin's army is hollow. Where? The CIA knows why. It's been hollowed out by the people in the military who are building huge ships and villas in the Riviera. They don't have ammunition, they don't have communications equipment, they don't have enough this, that, and the other, because it's been hollowed out. That's what was happening throughout the communist system. Okay. Now Ceausescu knew this. In fact, he encouraged it. He was creating his own oligarch system of people who are powerful in the government, whose wealth depended on him and the system remaining in power. So that is, in fact, a continuation of the old czar system or of the king system, but under a communist patina, right? So then the question is, what happened when communism fell? Now, during this communist period, the Securitate, the security services, knew about these oligarchs, these apparatchiks were stealing money, and they had dossiers. When communism fell, the Securitate found themselves with all these dossiers with damning information on everybody in the government, all right? And who was in the government? They were all former communists. They were all Iliescu, who took over from Ceausescu, used to be Iliescu's propaganda chief, among other things. So they all had dossiers. They all were crooked. They all had stolen from the government. In fact, if you didn't steal, you were suspect. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what happened during the transition? You had privatization of state companies. And all of these companies had to be equally privatized to all the people who worked in it and so forth. Well, they all ended up in the hands of a few.
And see, Bill, this is why I have my great suspicions about your being in the intelligence agency. Because you're reading my questions one after the other and just answering them. Because yes, I mean the Securitate, like yeah, I mean the Romanian oligarchs, and I want to get to that. Like who? Like you mentioned, these were some of the people who were in power once Ceausescu was knocked out. Like who came into power, but also, and I think you were sort of moving into this with the Securitate, and you sort of answered it. You know, communism already had its mob bosses, but did the fall of communism also create more mob bosses and sort of, I guess. And did it create more of an underworld, like a criminal underworld?
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, they always say behind a great fortune is a great crime, right? So how were these oligarchs formed? Well, who were these oligarchs? These oligarchs were all former Securitate officials who left the Securitate. And everybody's idea of the oligarchs is that they were smart and the government was dumb, and somehow they stole these companies that the government was trying to privatize. That's not what happened. What happened was there was a symbiotic relationship with the government, the officials in the government. The government steered all of these companies to the hands of these few who became the oligarchs for two reasons. One, these Securitate officials had damning evidence on all of them because they all stole and they were all informants for the Securitate and everything else. But secondly, they didn't even have to use that for blackmail. They were bribing them. They, the people in the government, became either the recipients of huge bribes or secret partners in the new companies that were being privatized. And these companies went into the hands of former security officials. And this went in Bulgaria, it took place in Czech Republic and many other places, not in all of them. East Germany, for instance, didn't have a chance to create oligarchs because it united with West Germany, and they were in charge of privatization. But it happened in most of the other communist states. So, but they became basically anonymous for a long time because these new companies were registered in Liechtenstein and Luxembourg, so nobody really knew who owned them, okay? But these oligarchs then, what did they do? They started buying up media companies, which they then used for propaganda purposes, which they knew how to do well from the communist days. They were all former communists. And they used them to control public opinion and to control whatever other government came into power. So to this very day, the oligarchs are said to control Romania as well as other former communist states. But, you know, you don't have to be communist to have oligarchs because the whole system goes back to, you know, for thousands of years. So we have Erdogan in Turkey. He's been in power for 20 years. He created an oligarch system, giving no-bid contracts to his friends and family to prop him up. And then they buy up media companies, which they then use for propaganda purposes to keep him popular, even though, you know, he's a crook. And all of these people that he gave no-bid contracts to created houses that fell at the first sign of tremor because they stole. Not only did they steal by getting no-bid contracts, but they stole from the equipment and the materials that they had to use in order to create those houses. So in Hungary, Viktor Orban is using the oligarch system. He calls it an illiberal democracy. And in fact, he brags and he says, look, the oligarch system, our new Rockefellers and Carnegies, is there to ensure that our country doesn't slide back into communism. Yeah. That's, but what's he doing? He's propping up himself with the oligarchs that he's creating.
So, I mean, but are these the oligarchs? And
I mean, can we work with these oligarchs? Because this just sounds like business as usual. You know, when the Roman Empire fell, the rich landowners were the ones who became the kings, the princes. And it just evolved into the, you know, what happened with the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, where, you know, Europe just turned into a bunch of, you know, kingdoms and, you know, principalities and all that. So I don't know. I mean, just, are they a threat to us? To me, it sounds like it's more stable than when Libya fell. And, you know, Gaddafi controlled everything. But when Gaddafi fell, look at the kind of chaos that took place in Libya. Can we then say that these oligarchs are preventing chaos from taking place in these nations?
Did you read my second book?
I did not.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I answered that question in the second book. How did these oligarchs get formed in Romania and who helped them? Okay. It is a theory which, like I said, Viktor Orban pushes himself, that the oligarch system is no different than, you know, the Carnegies and the Rockefellers we had in our country that provided an upper class that made sure that capitalism in some form or other succeeded. Now, it didn't quite form the same way because nobody gave them land or no bid contracts, or maybe they did, and we don't know about it, or at least I don't know about it. But they certainly used all sorts of methods to control competition and so forth. So it is more flagrant. These guys became oligarchs overnight because they were given companies without having created them. You know, most of these other people in our country create their own companies from scratch, okay? These people never created a damn thing. They were just former security apparatchiks who were loyal to whoever was at the moment in power and therefore were given these companies and became wealthy overnight. They didn't invent anything, you know, any of that. Okay, so that's a difference there. Okay, now, is it better than sliding back into communism? Why do we have that? Why do we have to make a decision between those two extremes, right? I mean, you could have a democracy where the wealth of the country is not being stolen by a few in the security services.
But that's going to take time because, you know, when World War I ended, the interwar period, I think they called it.
Yeah.
I want to say that Czechoslovakia was really the only democracy in Central Europe because, you know.
Wrong. Romania was a democracy.
Romania was a kingdom, was it not?
Well, it had a king, but it was like England. It had a king, had a parliament.
Okay.
It had a prime minister. And so. Yes,
but what I was saying is that they were not used to, you know, they were not used to the way a democratic nation, they didn't know how to go about it, and they slid back into fascism. Most of them did, or quite a few of them did. So, I mean, now I think they're better at it because they've had, you know, how long has the war's been over? What, for 80 years? So they've had practice. So maybe, you know, some of these nations that, you know, they have practice because they've been under communism. And I don't know.
That is Putin's excuse. Okay, Putin's excuse today is that Russians never had any experience with any kind of self-governance, any kind of democracy, or even close to that. They went from a czar system to a communist system. And so they all like and are used to a strong central government. And in fact, when Putin, after he left the KGB in 1990, he went to St. Petersburg. This is what I talk about in my third book. And in St. Petersburg, he latched onto the lapels of a professor of law named Sobchak, who became mayor, and he became the deputy mayor. And he became basically the fixer of St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg at that time was the most violent city in Russia. And he had to deal with the mafia, with old KGB, with new KGB called the FSB. And in order to put together St. Petersburg to make it function. And one of the things he tried was to create a city council with 400 elected officials. And it was a disaster. I mean, he was open to a democratic system, Putin was at first. And it was a disaster. They couldn't make up their minds even to name officials. Everything that they tried to do, somebody had an objection to. So they eventually, Moscow put an end to it. Okay, they just dissolved it. And Putin decided Russians aren't ready for democracy. It's a messy system and they can't agree on anything. And so he basically decided that a strong leader had to be in charge of Moscow to bring it to its feet, back on its feet. So his whole idea was formed during that St. Petersburg period. Anyway, so what are you saying? Because people didn't have experience, they shouldn't be given a chance to learn, they don't have time. Well, that is an explanation that Putin uses for Russia. And in China, it works also. Basically, the Chinese have a pact with the government that says as long as you don't enter politics or don't involve yourself into politics, you can make money and do whatever you want, right? Same thing with Putin. But then things start to go wrong and Putin enters a war. The oligarchs start feeling wheezy, you know, and Putin, if you remember, there was a report where he got them together at the beginning of the Ukraine war and he told them, I made you and I can destroy you. So you'd better be part of the plan. That's what an oligarch is. I made you and I can destroy you.
Do you think that the fix for that would be an enlightenment period? Because in the Middle East, we pushed for democracy in Iraq. And in I know in Lebanon, they had elections and Hezbollah was elected into power. In Iraq, they elected, I don't remember the first guy's name, but he was a bit of a radical. In Egypt, when Mubarak was overthrown, they brought in Morsi, who was head of the Muslim Brotherhood. You know, I could make excuses for them, but you know, in the West, we had the Enlightenment period, and that Enlightenment period heavily influenced the Founding Fathers to create the kind of system that we use today, and I know that it encouraged many other nations to follow suit.
No, you have absolutely a good argument there. In fact, the Russians were protected from many of our historical periods. They didn't have a renaissance. I mean, they fed off of Western Europe renaissance, but they never had one of their own, okay? And they never had an enlightenment period. They never really had a scientific period, you know, under communists. The communists were basically stealing most of the things from us. So the people don't understand democracy in their gut, but, you know, with the communications the way it is today, they understand it. They see how it is. They can travel to other countries. They, you know, they see that how it functions. It's messy. Like Churchill said, it's the worst system of all, except for all the others. But you know, you have to bring the whole planet along at some point with some form of representative government, I think.
Yeah, that's a tough task, considering like all of the nations and even, large portions of continents that don't do representative government. And it's sort of like you were saying, like this is going back, the whole oligarch system goes back, to, well, I mean,
The despot.
in you said Aristotle. I mean, we're talking thousands of years ago.
It was, the oligarchy was discussed in Herodotus
Yeah.
when they were discussing should we have a democracy, an oligarchy, or, a king or a dictator.
Well, Plato was not for democracies. He wanted a prince, basically.
But that's how Darius became the king of Persia. He had a discussion with his little round table, and they decided, okay, let's have one tyrant ruling everything. It's the most efficient system, and
Yeah, to an
he got
extent,
elected.
I think we've talked about that on the show. Like sometimes I think we may oversell the idea of democracy as if no other system is feasible, when in fact there are plenty of other governmental systems that are feasible. But it may come down to moments, like you were saying, Bill, about communication, where you're on social media and you're in a different country that doesn't have democracy, and you see other people enjoying the democratic freedoms, and wanting that, but by on the side of that other on the other side of the token is, well, if we try that in the position that we're in, there's a really good chance we could collapse. And to an extent, you sort of saw that with the fall of communism, the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s, where you were trying, and I think you mentioned this, you discussed this in either, I think it was in your second book, where you're talking about the transition from communism into capitalism, and it was an economic system that was not readily understood. And history shows that they really, the Soviet blocs and Russia itself, really struggled to try to figure out capitalism, and therefore you sort of turn into this oligarch system. And it's like, well, we'll just use capitalism via the oligarchs, but at the same time, you run into such corruption that you do build houses that don't stand because everybody's pulling from each other's pockets.
Well, yeah, let me talk about that. I mean, if we've had communists in this country, in the 50s, we had writers and actors. Communism, if you read Marx, it sounds nice. Everyone, gives what he can, receives what he needs, all for one and one for all, like the Three Musketeers. It's actually You could be see it as a religious thing, except that he hated religion. But you could see it as a Christian idea where, we're all working for the common good. The problem is it doesn't take into account human nature. Okay, we have become the most powerful species on this planet, not because just of our brains, but because we are the most aggressive also. We want to be the best. We want the better of our neighbor. We want to excel. In the communist system, nobody worked for two reasons. One, because they guaranteed a job for everybody. How did they do that? Well, they packed all of their companies and their farm, collective farms with too many employees. Okay. When the communist system fell, half of those employees had to be fired in order for the new private company to become profitable. In Romania, in 1990, unemployment was at 45%, okay? Because half the population now was no longer needed. Okay, so the communist system didn't work for that reason, but it also didn't work because people had no incentive to work. Why would I work for the government? Why would I sweat for the government? I get the same pay whether I work or not. And they can't fire me. So nobody worked. They worked half a day and then they got drunk, or then they went out to stand in line for bread and milk because there was never enough. And so that's how the whole system, you know, hobbled along. Nobody knew how in Russia or Romania, how a capitalist system worked. You know what a Romanian guy told me once? He was a smart guy. He was an architect. This was in the 80s. And I was there for like a month. He says, do you know what the gypsies do? He didn't like the gypsies. They were like the usual people who are blamed for everything in Romania. He says, they go to Turkey because they're allowed to, because they're gypsies. They're allowed to travel. And they buy things in Turkey, and then they bring them back and sell them for three times what they paid for them. I said, and? Well, they should be arrested because they're doing something illegal. How can they charge three times? I said, well, if you don't like to pay three times, why don't you go to Turkey, come back and sell it for two times what you paid for them? That's competition. He couldn't understand competition, okay? That's the basis of capitalism, I tried to explain to him. Anyway, the point is nobody understood it. In Russia, nobody understood savings accounts. Nobody understood investment. Nobody understood good relationships with your customer in a restaurant because they didn't have to. Everything was taken care of from cradle to grave. It made children out of them in many respects, at least economically. Okay. So, of course, when you had to become a capitalist country, the Russians didn't know anything about it. And in fact, there are many books that talk about the fact that the only people who knew were the black marketeers who dealt with the West and the KGB, which also had companies in the West to fund their black market and their operations in the West. So they are the ones who were brought into the government to teach the government how to deal in a capitalist market.
Did you mention that the KGB turned into the FBS or the FSB?
And SVR and several other ones.
What did the Securitate turn into? Or did it turn into anything?
SRI. And I mean, they turned into like 10 different departments. Okay. But the same people are in charge, or their children and relatives. So in fact, the security services have become a kind of family business, okay? Relatives and friends are in it that have been all along in the Russian, in the communist system. And they not only control the security services, but they control much of the wealth in the country.
So, I mean, what do you think's the future of, like, it's not a, you're not painting a beautiful picture of Eastern Europe. I mean, what is the future of their government? I mean, is it just oligarchy?
In Poland, it has changed. You know, there was a government until this last election a couple of days ago that was based on the same Viktor Orban type oligarch system that has been overthrown. It was a so-called populist government, if you want to call it that, but it's really a word for fascist government. And what it's done, it was trying to control the media in order to get reelected, and people basically revolted and elected a middle of the road government that was more democratic. So hopefully Poland will come back to become a more democratic country.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, do you think with these oligarchs and the fact that, you know, there hasn't been a enlightenment in that area and they're not too familiar with democracy, that they can be a little bit more authoritarian when it comes to keeping traditions? Because I know Hungary and Poland and even Russia, they consider themselves defenders of, let's say, the Christian faith, or defenders of tradition, and they don't want to open up their borders to Muslim migration. So will that, you know, because, you know, if you look at what happened with Spain, one of the reasons why Francisco Franco became the dictator of Spain for so long was because, you know, there was a large percentage of Spaniards who did not want communism. And if that means we're going to have an authoritarian fascist to protect us from communism and protect us from the church, then so be it. Is that going to be how the Eastern Europeans are going to be?
No, I think that's a natural assumption, and it's also, yes, it is a natural response to some of these forces by the Eastern Europeans. But there's a difference now. They are part of the European Union, and they are part of NATO, all of these countries. And they have a whole system around them that buttresses the European way of thinking and doing, okay? So even if they start veering toward a more authoritarian regime, they are pulled back, okay, into the fold. And the people understand that. I mean, if they have a chance to vote, you can see that they're voting to bring them back toward the Europeans. The Ukrainians, for instance, were the most corrupt communist country before the war. They want to be part of the European Union. They want to be part of NATO, not just because they want to be protected from the Russians, but because they want that life. They want that open life. They want the life of culture. They want the life of free speech and so forth. And that is something that once they taste it, they don't want to let go of it, okay? We are still seen by the Romanians and by all those Eastern European countries as the, you know, the light up on the hill, you know, as the idea of ideal democracy. We still are, believe it or not, okay? Even more than we believe in ourselves. Okay, and that's because all of these people dream about that. Even if it never gets accomplished the way their dreams are, they still have those dreams about us and about what they want to be. So, you know, you're going to have strong people trying to get power in every one of these countries. And in here, what are you talking about? Don't look at Eastern Europe. Look at here. You know, I don't want to get into politics, but we had a close call with an election that was taken over, you know. So don't think we are so different.
Oh, no. I'm not suggesting we're better or, you know, that we have this ideal way of doing things. But I always wondered if I know Putin likes to say that the decadence of the West far outweighs the freedom in terms of what, you know, the balance, what's, you know, if the decadence is this bad, then the freedom is not that good. And I don't know how much that's going to resonate with the people. I know it resonates with many of the Arab nations who don't want to see their sons wearing dresses or their women's becoming whores. They want the traditional conservative values. So
Let's keep the Middle East out because there's a religious component there.
Right. And I mean, I'm Middle Eastern, so I've got that intersectionality card that I can use to defend.
No, I understand. But if we take religion out for a second and just look at Russia and the former communist countries, forget about decadence. Think about companies. Where are their Microsofts, their Apples, their Teslas? Do they have anything going for them economically? No. Okay. They never invented anything. Well, they probably did a few things. They had a good space program. A lot of it was stolen from us. They stole the atomic bomb from us. Basically, they don't have the economic and the invention capacity that a free market enterprise system has. And part of it is freedom, intellectual freedom, You know, there's an old joke, you know, remember Stalin hated intellectuals. And the old joke in Romania was, why do communists travel in threes? One to read, one to write, and the other guy to keep an eye on those two intellectuals. And that's because they're afraid that the intellectuals would topple their government, okay? And in any despotic system, you value loyalty more than you value competence. Okay? That's why a lot of the generals in Russia today are not the most competent. They're the most loyal. And they're losing a battle with a country like Ukraine. Why is anybody afraid of them in terms of NATO, for Christ's sakes? They can't even win a battle with Ukraine. They showed how empty they are. So nothing works well in a communist country, not their economy and not their military. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, it is the freedom to free market enterprise. I think you nailed it. I mean, and I think the balance is, to Alan's point, like the decadence, but I don't think it has anything to do with moving forward as far as an economy. And I think that you can only move forward by allowing people to think for themselves. And it is interesting because you think of Russia pre-1917, and you think of all the art, the literature, the music, just the beauty, the architecture, just all these great things that came out of it. And then all of a sudden, for the past 100 plus years now, that's just sort of come to a standstill, except for the things that they steal and then replicate. Right. But like you said, that right there is just an echo effect of, you know, that is heard or seen throughout all the Soviet bloc nations. Like you were saying, like all they did was, like, Ceausescu knew everybody was stealing from the coffers and everybody was stealing from everybody else. The most powerful were stealing the most, and it was okay. And that's a culture that has to change. And I think it's a really good thing that you bring up. It's like the people of the East and in Eastern Europe, like, see us, rightly or wrongly, as this beacon on the hill, the light on the hill. And it reminded me a little bit. And you see that via the communications, like you were talking about. And I know you mean like the news and social media. And I know the barrier between North Korea and South Korea, it is sort of known, it's been going on for quite some time, where the South Koreans will throw over flash drives of TV shows and different things like that, so the North Koreans can get a glimpse of, here's what's really going on over here, despite what you're being told. And I think it's the joke, right? It's the, you know, one guy to read, one guy to write, and one guy to keep an eye on everybody. And I think eventually that's how you change things. And I think it will be, well, maybe a generation has to pass with a new way of thinking about the world in order to see significant change. And maybe somehow, despite the fact that I hate social media, but I use it all the time, maybe that's how that change takes place. So,
yeah, social media has very positive things. I mean, it did a lot in the Arab Spring. It did a lot in the in terms of BBC and Voice of America during the communist days in the 80s. In fact, there was a book written by a guy named Pacepa, a Romanian three-star general who defected in 1978. He was the head of the External Security Service. And he told the Americans everything. It destroyed Ceausescu's security service. He then wrote a book about Ceausescu and all his secrets, which was read over the BBC and the Voice of America in 1986 or 8, I can't remember. And all the Romanians heard it being read, the whole book, every night. And they say they believe that is what sparked the revolution that eventually toppled in 89. is knowing how corrupt he was. And one more thing, to show how corrupt Ceausescu was, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but he used to sell the CIA the latest military equipment that he received from the Soviet Union. And I'm not just talking about the plans. I'm talking about the actual stuff. He delivered the latest Russian tank to the U.S. military, and he delivered the latest radar system that the American military used to create their stealth bomber, because they knew what abilities the Russian radar system had, and so they were able to use that to create their bomber. All of that for, you know, millions of dollars that he received from the CIA, which saved billions in our development of our military. But to show how greedy he was, he didn't give a damn about giving secrets away.
God bless him, right?
He did show up for the 1984 Los Angeles Olympics. I remember that.
That's gotta mean something, right? Yeah. He was probably dropping off some equipment while he was while
yeah.
Hey, Bill, it's been fantastic. And I had one question left that I wanted to ask. The last time we talked, and I think it slipped my mind, the Johnny Walker Black that is always in your books. What is that? Why is that?
Poetic license.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you knew, like, hey, this is what the CIA agents like to drink, all of them. So,
if they're communist, shouldn't they be drinking Johnny Walker Red?
It's not the communists that are drinking the whiskey, it's the CIA.
Maybe it's the black market, Johnny Walker black market. That's
there you go. Alan with his typical wonderful jokes that land like an old Soviet bomb.
I like to indulge in Johnny Walker Black. I got a couple of bottles right here.
There you go. And he actually almost worked for the CIA, too.
My favorite is Lagavulin these days. Have you guys ever had it? Single malt.
Which one?
Lagavulin. Lagavulin.
Let me go grab what I have. Hold on.
Exactly. The Lagavulin, is that how you say it? Lagavulin?
Lagavulin.
Yeah. When we come to New York, we'll have a glass.
Oh, I'd love that. That would be great.
Or when I come to New York and Alan can stay behind. And
all right. I don't know if I made too much noise, but I have my collection here.
Oh, my God.
All right. And then.
Green label, blue label.
Yeah, I've got a green somewhere.
Yeah.
I got a blue, two blacks, a green, and the mother of all.
The red light. But you know what the irony about the blue label is? It was created for the Saudis.
Was it?
When they the Saudis who come to London and drink and dance and so forth, but don't allow anybody else to do it in their own countries.
Yeah, I know they do that in Bahrain. They would go to Bahrain and do that. But I think that they would use the green because that's part of their flag.
The blue.
Okay. Well,
hey man, you gotta restrain the people's decadence, as Alan.
That's right.
Hey Bill, thanks again for being with us. And
it's a great pleasure.
Thanks again.
All right, thank you guys.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we trust that you enjoyed that conversation with Bill Maz. If you haven't yet, go get his book and books and read them. It's a good idea to read them in order, though you technically don't have to, but I recommend it. So you can, you know, buy them wherever books are sold. I think that everybody likes to go on Amazon. But anyways, why don't you just take a little field trip to the bookstore and go buy them yourself? So Alan, you know that I relatively recently came back from Washington, D.C. And dang it, I really wish, now that I'm thinking about it, I wish I'd have brought this up to Bill. Because I went and visited the Spy Museum, and it was pretty freaking cool. And in the entrance, I don't know if I sent you the photo, probably not, because as far as the list of friends, you're pretty far down on the list. But in the entrance, is Sean Connery's Aston Martin from Goldfinger. Like, the original. They had it on loan, and I was mesmerized. It's stunning, stunning, beautiful car. Up close, I was in high heaven. There you have that.
Didn't it blow up in Goldfinger?
Yes, but I don't think they really blew it up.
Okay, well, I did get the very last of the Bond movies, which I think you told me it kind of sucked.
I didn't like it. I didn't like it, and you are not going to like it, but I would like for you to watch it before our next episode so we can touch on that and just you can tell me how you feel about it.
Yeah, well, I remember you mentioned something about a monologue and all that, but why don't we get Bill, you know, now that I know what happens at the end, maybe Bill's stories could, you know, kind of lead the way since things are different.
You know what? I should just message him and say, what did you think about the last James Bond? And then read it on the show next time. But speaking of James Bond, do you really think Pierce Brosnan was not as good as the ones who came before him? You really think that Pierce Brosnan was not as good as Roger Moore?
Well, no. I think that the
Lazenby?
Movies... I think the movies... Now, I know Timothy Daltrey, you know...
Dalton. Hmm? Dalton.
What did I say?
Timothy Dalton.
Timothy Dalton.
Daltrey.
Okay, sorry. Timothy Dalton. The first one was good. The second one was a bit weak. But I didn't like the Pierce Brosnan movies, the Bond movies. I thought he was a fantastic James Bond. I thought he played the part perfectly. But when you have Charlie Sheen's ex-wife as a nuclear scientist... What was her name? Dr. Christopher or Christmas Snow or something like that. I don't know what the hell her name was.
Yeah. She was no pussy galore. That's for sure.
Okay. Yes. Yes. But then the one where they went, I don't know if it was in Iceland or Greenland or whatever it was, but he was on an iceberg, a giant iceberg that this laser came and it was a North Korean one where he was captured, but His jet or whatever it was hanging over the cliff, and the laser comes and he does something where he's holding on and using a paragliding or a wind sail or something. And I'm like going, no, this is stupid. This is the dumbest thing I have ever seen in a James Bond movie. Because I mean, if you look at the other Sean Connery ones, they're a little bit realistic.
Yeah, they're in the realm of possibility. I will say this. GoldenEye is one of the better James Bond movies. His first one was actually quite good.
Right.
I don't mind Tomorrow Never Dies either. That one's, as far as Pierce Brosnan films, that one.
They all have the same titles. Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough. You know, Goldfinger, Thunderball, you knew what those are about. Man with a Golden Gun, you know what that's about. But his movies...
Yeah, The World Is Not Enough was actually not too shabby either.
Is that that Englishman that wanted to start a war with China? I don't know.
But I think your North Korean one, yeah, that one was quite terrible.
Yeah, the North Korean one sucked.
I'm glad that you clarified that it's not Pierce Brosnan who was bad, because I thought he was a very good James Bond. But it's the films.
Yeah.
Much like the Roger Moore films, I To Live and Let Die, and, you know, just, I even The Man with the Golden Gun.
Man with the Golden Gun was a good movie.
It was just a one-on-one. That's all that was. I'm like, okay, I think I can live without this one.
Live and Let Die was a bit weak, but Man with the Golden Gun was good. Moonraker was good.
Moonraker was garbage. Go ahead.
No, it was not. Oh, come on. Octopussy was a great movie.
Octopussy wasn't too shabby.
No. Octopussy was a great movie. Now, the one with in San Francisco, A View to a Kill.
A View to a Kill. Yeah.
It had potential.
We could go forever, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, that's all I got for you. It's always great to see you, although... digitally, but hey, that's enough for me.
Okay, well, I don't have, I got interviewed by 10-7.
I don't want to hear about it.
You don't
want to
hear about that? All right, fine. We talked about the situation in the Middle East.
And yet you continue.
Uh-huh. I'm not going to go into any details.
You know, I can only imagine. Yeah.
10:70 a.m. on Saturday morning. Yeah. So
you can check it out online.
It was not live.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is it for our show. We will talk with you next week.